Welcome to WISO Weekend, WISO's weekly radio magazine. I'm Jerry Kenny. On today's program, Ellen Belcher with Politics Ohio. New York Times best-selling author Andy Andrews will talk about his new book aimed at voter apathy. And later in the program, poet Gary Michener makes a stop on Conrad's Corner. Up first, this weekend, Springfield City Commissioners voted 3-2 against amending the city's anti-discrimination code to include gay municipal workers. Assistant Mayor Joyce Chilton and Commissioners Dan Martin and Kevin O'Neill voted against the legislation. Mayor Warren Copeland and Commissioner Karen Duncan stood in favor of the amendment before last Tuesday night's overflow crowd. Commissioner Duncan spoke with Clark County reporter Wayne Baker about the legislative effort's history and its future.
Well, good afternoon to you. And I just wanted to ask you, I know that the legislation was finally voted on, and I know it was a tough process. Ultimately, it was defeated. And at this point, where do things stand?
Well, the process was brought to us more than a year ago by Equality Springfield, which is a group of folks in Springfield and Clark County who are advocating for equal rights for the GBLT community. The process finally got brought to the commission in a formal way last fall when I had been trying to make a motion to bring it before the commission, but I couldn't get a second. Finally, the mayor handed the gavel over to the assistant mayor at the time, who was Dan Martin, you know, to allow him to second the motion to get it out there on the table. Once we did that, it was immediately moved to kick it down the road by Commissioner Martin, who wanted to have it studied by the Human Relations Board. That happened. It was a long process. It was a divisive process. There were people on the Human Relations Board that I think found it very onerous. It was very time-consuming for staff and the volunteer board folks. That board came back to the commission with a recommendation not to pass the ordinance, not to add the additional language of sexual orientation to the non-discrimination ordinance. So when the recommendation came back, it was split. There were 4 people in favor of not adding the language and 3 people in favor of adding the language. So the split vote came back to us, and it was accompanied with minority positions from each of the board members. In fact, both sides, the individual board members, added information for the commission. It was a long process for the commission. I find it interesting that I don't think that the vote was any different taken last night than it would have been had we taken the vote a year ago. It became a divisive issue in the community. One church in particular was very active in their opposition. Equality Springfield was active in their promoting the issue and encouraging the commission to vote for it.
I know that you were very supportive, and just to add the language, are you disappointed that at this point there's just no protection for gay municipal workers to the anti-discrimination code?
I believe that we would probably have support for adding language to the municipal workers. I think that we would. The issue, in my view, and I spoke to this at the meeting last night, the big dividing issue is that there are people who believe that homosexuality is a choice, a lifestyle choice, and that people choose to live a lifestyle of homosexuality because that's what they want to do, not because that's who they are. I don't believe that. I completely reject that, and I think that most serious scientific research supports my position on that. But there are a lot of people, particularly in the Christian community, that view homosexuality as, and I'm quoting here, an abomination. We have heard that multiple times in the commission meetings, and we've also heard people talk about the immorality and the fact that these people are rejected by God. And in fact, when I was speaking last night and saying that I did not consider the GBLT community to be an abomination, there were people that shouted at me from the crowd, that shouted out, "Read your Bible, read your Bible." And I do not believe that the Bible tells me that people who, with, you know, in a same-sex relationship are unlovable by God. I just don't accept that, and I don't believe it.
Is this a moot point now, or do you think the issue will come up again?
I think that it's a moot point as long as the commission is as it sits now. In other words, there will be three of us up for election in 2013. If the three of us are reelected, or if the two commissioners who are opposed to the ordinance are reelected, whether I'm reelected or not, I don't think that there's any point in bringing it back to the same group of people. You won't have a different result.
Does this surprise you in 2012 that these types of feelings are still harbored by some in the Springfield area?
I would like to say that I'm horrified at the thought, but the truth is that I know my community fairly well, and I know it to be a fairly conservative place when it comes to social values. I'd also point out that we have one of the highest teen pregnancy rates in the state, and the state has among the highest in the nation. And I think that we have a lot of work to do in terms of social issues and educating our population about how to take care of yourself and how to be proud of yourself, regardless of who you are. I think that, so, in short, I guess I'm not terribly surprised. I was horribly disappointed. I had hoped that with the extra research and all of the information, one of the others might have eventually come to see the advantages to the community to add that language to the non-discrimination ordinance, because I believe that Springfield should be a place where we don't discriminate against anyone, whether it's on the basis of skin color, religion, gender, national origin, age, disability. You know the drill.
Springfield City Commissioner Karen Duncan speaking with WYSO's Wayne Baker. This is WYSO Weekend on WYSO.
Welcome to Politics Ohio. I'm Ellen Belcher, filling in for Emily McCord. Today I'm talking with Bob Bennett, Chairman Emeritus of Ohio's Republican Party and reportedly the longest-serving state Republican chairman in the country. Thanks for talking to me, Mr. Bennett.
Good morning.
Is it fair to say that in over the last two decades you've never seen a Republican primary like this one? I'm asking because I don't remember the fights between George Bush and Bob Dole in 1988, or between Dole and Pat Buchanan in 96, or George W. and John McCain in 2000 being this fierce. And certainly in 2008, Mitt Romney didn't give John McCain this much trouble. Are we in unprecedented territory here?
Oh, I think so. And I think it has more to do with the change in the rules of the Republican National Committee regarding the convention delegates. I think what you're seeing is that there's nobody that's broken away from the pack. So I think that what's happened is that right now the intensity of the campaign is to get one person that would be the candidate to stop Romney. Now, what you're arguing about in the Republican primary is who's more conservative. 4 years ago, it was who was more liberal, Hillary Clinton or Barack Obama. But I don't think that the primary process hurts candidates. And whoever emerges on the Republican side will be a better candidate for going through the primary process on the Republican side in 2012.
Republican primary voters are decidedly more conservative than likely GOP voters in the fall general elections.
I think that's true.
Do you ever worry that your nominee is being chosen by a small but especially strident wing of the party?
Well, I don't worry too much about that. I think that what you're going to find out is that whoever the nominee is, that the Republicans will coalesce behind that nominee, and the stay-at-home Republicans, the soft Republicans, and a lot of the independents will come together in the fall.
Now, Super Tuesday is next week, and Ohio is the big prize among those 10 contests. What would you tell the Republican candidates they should be talking to Ohioans about?
Well, you know, Ohioans mirror the nation better than any other state. If you're down in southwest Ohio, you're going to probably flaunt your conservative credentials. If you're over in the western part of the state or southeastern part of the state, you might be talking about social conservatism. In Northeast Ohio, the Cleveland media market, you might have more of a moderate message.
A lot of their rhetoric has been about hot-button social issues. Do you think the candidates are making a mistake focusing on abortion, contraception, gay rights, women in the military, and their own religious views?
Well, I think, you know, that some people will think that. There are some in the Republican Party that that's an important issue to and is important in determining who they're going to vote for. But if you look at the four candidates that are left, there's not that much difference.
Let's talk a little bit about Ohio and Governor Kasich. Governor John Kasich and your successor, Kevin DeWine, are barely on speaking terms. Governor Kasich wants Chairman DeWine out. Ohio has a long history of governors wanting to put their own person in charge of the party. Four-term Governor Jim Rhodes and then Governor George Voinovich each wanted their own person in, and I think Governor George Voinovich came after you. Whose side are you on in this spat?
Well, I support John Kasich and his policies very strongly. I think he'll go down as probably the best governor of this century because I think he's making a systemic change in the way this state operates, and I think it's a long time in coming. But at the same time, I think that Kevin DeWine has done a good job as chairman. So whatever happened, I think, between Governor Kasich and Kevin DeWine is somewhat on the personal level, and it has to be dealt with. I mean, we need to calm the waters down. We're into an important election year. Our most important job this year from a Republican standpoint is to carry Ohio for the Republican nominee.
I've been talking to Bob Bennett, former chair of Ohio's Republican Party. It was great talking with you today, Mr. Bennett. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Ellen.
As Ohio and the nation prepare for the upcoming Super Tuesday primaries, New York Times best-selling author Andy Andrews is asking the question, why do so many Americans choose not to participate in the electoral process? Andrews is the author of the newly published How Do You Kill 11 Million People? It's a book about voter apathy and America's current political culture. The book's title and its content were inspired by another question of historical significance. He asked that question when we spoke by phone this week.
How in the world would thousands and thousands of people load themselves onto boxcars with relatively few Nazi soldiers? You know, why didn't they just rush them, or why didn't they run or hide or something? And when I found the answer, I was stunned because it is an answer and a method that some elected leaders still use today to achieve various goals. The answer to how do you kill 11 million people is you lie to them.
That's a good point. So where did that lead you?
Well, here's where it kind of connected with me. Look, Hitler didn't take over. He was elected. They elected him. This was a democracy and educated people with ready access to news media. And, of course, in bad economic times and a government building burned and he got his Congress to give him emergency powers, then he created the law for the protection of the people. That sounds familiar, doesn't it? I'm just doing it for you. And here we go. Well, in our country, there are 545 people who are currently responsible for every problem America faces. Every budget that's drawn up, every law that's passed, every bill that's offered, 545 people, one president, nine Supreme Court justices, 100 senators, and 435 members of Congress. Did you know that in the past 25 years, there's not been a single presidential election that has been won by more than 10 million votes? They've all been that close. And yet, in the past 25 years, there's not been a single presidential election in which fewer than 100 million people of voting age did not vote.
Those numbers are staggering, and it seems also almost unsurmountable with what you're trying to do.
Yeah, you know, with one exception, in the past 25 years, literally more people vote for American Idol than vote for president. And what I am trying to get people to understand, here's the good news about this book, because people go, how do you kill 11 million people? Oh my gosh, that's depressing. No, this is hopeful, and I'll tell you why. One of the facts about what happened in Germany years ago is that country of 80 million people, the Nazi Party never had more than 8.5 million members. So literally, 10% of the population of this educated country drugged these people into a nightmare. And the reason was because 90% of them sat around and said, well, this can't happen here. Well, you know, he didn't say that. Well, that wasn't what he intended. And all of a sudden they look up and they're coming for their children. Well, if 10% of that population can drag that country into a nightmare, certainly 10% of us can do great things for our country and move our country into the direction of our choosing. Well, people say, but what can you do? What about those 100 million? Look, I don't know that Republicans and Democrats are ever going to convince each other of anything. But right in the middle of them, we have 100 million people who are evidently so disgusted with both of them that they don't even bother to vote. Or they're so depressed about their ability to change things. See, to me, Jerry, I look at that 100 million people and I say, that's 100 million undecided. That's 100 million people that evidently somebody has not ignited their passion enough to get them to walk outside the door, crank their car, drive to the schoolhouse or the fire station, and actually vote. And the great news is that in the past 25 years, there's not been a single election won by more than 10 million votes. They've all been that close. So we don't need all 100 million to vote. We just need 11 million. We've created a site called 11millionvotes.com. There, you can go to 11millionpeople.com or 11millionvotes.com, where it just gives you some facts to talk about and the ability to bring people to an understanding of what we can do if we just kind of gather together.
The GOP debates on television have been receiving higher ratings, but that's not translating to places like Iowa or some of the caucuses and primary votes.
You're right. It's not. And I think, Jerry, if you and I were to sit over a cup of coffee and say, okay, so why aren't these people voting? I think we would probably pretty quickly come to the conclusion. A lot of people look at the choices on either side and go, I don't like any of these guys. You know, I don't like the Democrat side. I don't like the Republican side. I don't like any of them. And so I'm not sure I can, in good conscience, vote for somebody that I don't really like. But here's what I would urge people to understand is right now in this country, I think everybody agrees we're at a tipping point. We are headed in a certain direction. If we do not choose the direction of our country, then things are going to be pretty tough for everybody. And so it needs, I really believe, this coming election, it's not really about the election, it's about the direction.
Andy Andrews is the author of the newly published How Do You Kill 11 Million People? It's about voter apathy and America's current political culture. Currently on the New York Times bestseller list. Andy, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you, buddy. I appreciate the time.
This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac for the third week of early spring. This week opens the season of early bulbs, even in the coldest years. The very earliest bulbs, of course, the snowdrops, the snow crocus, and the aconites, have already bloomed in the sunniest microclimates. But now it's time for the larger, brighter standard crocus and the small spring iris, the iris reticulata, to flower. When one thing happens, something else is always happening too. The flowering of those bulbs bears witness to the blossoming of silver maples and the red maples along city streets, the blooming of weedy henbit in the garden, the increasing flow of maple sap, the full emergence of pussy willows, the appearance of woolly bear caterpillars, the full bloom of the pure snow trillium along the rivers, the final bloom of skunk cabbage, the mating songs of red-winged blackbirds in the swamp, the time of pairing up for ducks and geese, the time for killdeer and woodcocks to arrive from the south and for juncos to depart for the north. When the early bulbs come in, then clover grows back in the pastures, and nettle tops are big enough for supper greens. Celandine and garlic mustard and sweet rocket grow bushy in the alleys. Violet leaves and horseradish leaves sprout in the garden. Honeysuckle leaves unravel on the branches closest to the ground. Buds lengthen and brighten on multiflora roses on mock orange and lilacs. Bleeding heart foliage pushes up from the mulch, and daylily leaves can be as tall as crows. buds on the daffodils foretell the next season of flowering bulbs and the deepening of early spring. Walleye, bass, and bluegills have begun to feed, and earthworms breed in the warming rains. This is Bill Felker with Poor Will's Almanac. I'll be back again next week with notes for the fourth week of early spring. In the meantime, look for daffodils, a golden banner of the next phase of the year.
Bill Felker contributes to newspapers nationwide, including the Yellow Springs News. Bill resides in Yellow Springs. Poor Will's Almanac is also available as a podcast at wyso.org.
Welcome to Conrad's Corner. From time to time, I do interviews with local poets. My interview today is with Gary Michener. Hi, Gary.
Good afternoon, I guess, at this point.
And your background as poet, as writer?
Well, I first started writing, I guess, in high school. I wrote one poem. It was published in the high school magazine, so I guess I thought I was a poet at that point.
Do you remember the poem?
No, I don't. I just remember that it was very bad.
Okay.
As I look back on it. But I met Wendell Berry and Hollis Summers when I was a freshman.
Wow.
And they influenced me. And so that's basically why I started writing. And I started writing actually a poem about a social realist 30s painter named Philip Evergood, and I won first prize in the college contest, and so that sort of validated that I was an okay poet.
And then were you an English major?
I was an English major. I knew in the 10th grade in high school that I wanted to be an English professor.
And where did you go to college?
I went to Wilmington College, just down the road.
And then you became a professor? How soon?
My first job was in high school, and I taught poetry in high school, and I had the students make up their own poetry magazine. So,
good. And was that around here?
Yes, I was in Dayton. And then after that, I went back to graduate school at the University of Michigan. Loved Ann Arbor, but I still took poetry. Then I came back and started teaching in Dayton at Sinclair.
And you were at Sinclair for?
For at least 40 years, because after I retired in 2006.
Yeah, I taught at Wittenberg for 30 years, and I used to say when people asked me how long, I said too long.
Too long.
Was that too long for you?
No, everybody thinks I retired too early. I decided I would retire when I turned 60.
And you still teach poetry?
Yes, I still teach part-time.
I've often wondered, actually, I never taught creative writing because somehow I didn't think creativity could be taught.
Well, I always tell my students that the first day, I cannot teach you to be creative, but I can do the writing technique part.
And basically, you taught writing technique.
Yes. My teachers, I had great teachers, and I could talk about my teachers, but they always made me write formal poems. I remember studying with Michael Harper, and he said, "You're going to write a Petrarchan sonnet." So I wrote a Petrarchan sonnet, but being sort of a wisecrack myself, I wrote about Petrarch and Laura. So I suppose if he had assigned us a Shakespeare sonnet, I would have written about Shakespeare and the Dark Lady or whatever.
Okay. And do you still teach formal poetry, or do you now teach the informal, the free verse?
No, I still think that it's important to teach the formal structures. So, yes, I have my students write sonnets and sestinas and villanelles and pantoums, iambic pentameter.
And do you try to teach informal poetry?
And then we do free verse, of course, and then I do other kinds of structures. But I want to give them that background because nobody really gave that background to me in college.
Well, we've been talking about poetry. I'd like to hear a sample of your own.
Oh, okay. I have a series of poems. I tend to write in series. One of my favorite series is about a character that I made up named Morgan. And so I'd like to read you a poem called Morgan Becomes a Horse. But this is a character, actually, it's E.M. Forrester. Morgan is his middle name. Anyway, it's called Morgan Becomes a Horse. His mother always told him that animals could remind him of unpleasant memories. He knew she was wrong, but not why. Was he in a hierarchy above the dogs which roamed on their country estate? Could he really see a resemblance anywhere in the barns where he enjoyed his one true childhood? He would find out. When he wrote novels, he knew nothing animal-like happened to him, yet they became so many fears manifested, passages and ends. When he looked at himself in the mirror, as he frequently did in secret, dreading that he would be found out, illusion was the magic he needed most to survive. He discovered a peaceful aura around him. And in dreams, he did discover memory, but his mother had been wrong. They were pleasant. In the barn, he tried to talk to the horse. No kinship established. He opened the obliging mouth with new strength, placed his head inside, then climbed farther until he rested there safely, a curious soldier sequestered in his own Trojan trick.
Good. Do you have any intentional structure here other than the line length?
I try to balance my poems. I try to think about stanzaic form. This is not a particular type of poem as such, formal poem, but you will notice that I do keep the same number of lines in each stanza.
Yes.
And I think it's important, what I call the decorum of the poems, how the poem looks on the page.
Okay. And are there any specific echoes or overtones of E.M. Forster other than the name?
Well, the fact that I'm referring to this character as writing novels, and of course one of his most famous novels is Passage to India.
Okay. And you have another sample of one of your creative pieces of poetry?
Well, this occurred when I was in San Francisco, and I went to, I believe it was the 400th anniversary of Shakespeare's birth, and it was an exhibit. And I just sort of began imagining what Shakespeare would be doing if he were there in San Francisco. So it's called Shakespeare in San Francisco. The ritual first cut into slain deer was never yours, nor that first blast of the trumpet against monstrous regiments of women. On Castro Street, the knife was yours. The sounds belonged to men. When excesses in apparel were fashioned, you, the upstart crow, cut a figure like paper dolls in squares, not to seem something you wanted to hide, a conceit for your fancy. Mistaken identity you could not take as your own. Where streets did not know you, you flowed, a crowd out of control. How clever to celebrate masquerade, errors you could not correct. No one would know you. No one could keep you off the bay streets. You thought you knew enough when to seek relics carved from fallen trees, so any decay would have meaning. But towering over you, influential, living redwoods, unlike golden suspensions, a bridge like a net. When plague raged, no king entered through the arches. The hell mouth gaped open, waiting for mortality bills, skulls on the city side of the bridge. Your infection purified by ocean breeze, you went through with no second thought. You never discarded the other side of the mirror, always playing with your reflection. Like Macbeth, all accidents were backstage. You learned no heart rests within the beast, so the word glory mellowed your California discovery.
Thank you, Gary. That is, I think, a very rich poem. I know enough about Shakespeare to recognize a number of allusions and echoes, and I think it shows a very good understanding of Shakespeare as well as a good command of the English language.
Thank you. I remember very specifically that there was a bookstore in Sausalito called The Upstart Crow, so that's where I took that.
Yes, and that was Ben Johnson used that for
Ben Johnson.
Well, you show talent both as poet and reader and also as teacher. So I thank you very much for your contributions here.
Thank you.
Gary Michener.
That's it for this week's edition of WISO Weekend on member-supported 91.3 WYSO, Yellow Springs, Dayton, Springfield, and online at wyso.org. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us. Coming up next on WYSO, The Book Nook.
This week on American Roots, we cruise the Gulf Coast Highway with Deep South singer-songwriter Lucinda Williams. I'm Nick Spitzer. Join me for American Roots from PRX.
Once we rode together in a metal firecracker.
Catch American Roots this afternoon at 2 on member-supported 91.3 WYSO.
You know it's the right thing to do. You're listening to WYSO right now, but do you ever wonder what keeps the great news and music you rely upon on the air? It's you. Your support of WYSO makes the quality programming you listen to possible. Maybe you haven't gotten around to it yet, or maybe you supported WYSO in the past and you just need a reminder. Don't wait. Go to WYSO.org and pledge your support so we can keep bringing you the programs and music you count on every day. You know it's the right thing to do.